Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Eric.
You know, this has been another heavy week, on some levels, another productive week. But I think the most important thing is that when people say that this has been a week unlike any other that they can remember over the course of their lives, it's because we keep putting the pressure on. I think the most important thing to do is to keep moving forward and keep doing this. It's not that we've done 1 week and that's good enough. It's not that we've done 2 weeks and it's good enough. It's constant pressure on the system to make changes and to get the people out who are not going to make changes.
Yeah, I mean, like, when you say that this was another difficult week, I feel like it's been a very productive week. Like, I feel encouraged by it.
Agreed. That's in the end. But I think, like, to go through it, it's heavy. It's not easy to hear the helicopters. It's not easy to see the videos of people, you know, getting brutally assaulted by police officers.
Yeah, but that was at the top of the week. By the end of the week, it's like, it feels like all the cops have smartly backed off, not because they wanted to, because I think that a lot of cops are racist and shitty and use their power in abusive ways. But I think that the mayors have pulled the cops off and said, like, you cannot do whatever you were doing. You know, we haven't seen the same sort of Buffalo tactics, the same sort of, you know, New York, you know, kettling and all that shit.
Okay,
like, LA. Like, everybody has sort of backed off.
That may be true, but it's not like the rules have been rewritten. It's not like the police authority has been changed, and it's not like there's a new system there. So,
well, except for Minneapolis.
Well, the first steps in the process have been started in Minneapolis.
Yep, and then in New York, people are starting to defund. I mean, like, I'm just saying, I'm encouraged. I know. It's not.
It's sure encouraging. Great.
Yeah.
Job is not done.
Nope.
There's a long way to go. And guys, yes, make sure that you are registered to vote. Make sure you have absentee ballots coming to your mailbox. Yes, look forward to November on local and state and national levels. But that's not it. So the job is not done. For those people who are outside marching, shout out to you guys. Salute to you guys. Stay safe out there as best you can. For those people who are inside, there's lots of ways to contribute. You can contribute money to the NAACP, to the ACLU, to lots of bail funds for those protesters who have been locked up. There's hundreds.
Black businesses.
And
you know,
thousands of ways to contribute, whether you're outside or inside.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I agree.
Yeah,
it's nice to see that, like, we're both on the same page.
When are we not?
I don't know.
But anyway,
right now,
here we are, top of the week, and we wanted to present another creative that should be on your guys' radar, and I'm sure he is on a lot of people's radars. He's been talked about on this podcast. He's somebody that we've wanted to sit down with for a long time. Obviously, the circumstances here are not amenable to that, so we got him on the phone.
Yeah, I mean, like, we were supposed to be in LA.
We're talking about Calmatic.
We're talking about Calmatic, the Grammy Award winning.
Yes.
Oscar Award holding.
Yes.
Park Ranger.
Oh.
He was a park ranger. I feel like that's being, you know, written out of his story. He was a park ranger.
Yeah. He's talked about that one time.
One time in 2010 or something. But, like, one time he talked about him being a park ranger. And I think that people will come away from this and be like, wow, that park ranger did a lot of other things.
Yes. He is a father. He is a storyteller. He's a musician. He is a big time director. But you want to salute his service out there on the trails.
Listen, you know, the world is on fire. There's a possibility that none of these parks are going to exist in 5 years.
Before we get into the podcast, Jeff, I do want to make mention that we are an independent operation. There's no building behind us. There is no big financial backing behind us. We do everything ourselves. And if you guys appreciate the types of stories that we tell, if you appreciate the intentions that are in our hearts, and if you appreciate the execution that is in your ears, whenever we do a podcast, whenever we do a video, whenever we put out content, there is a very, very easy and awesome way to help support what we are doing, and that is to go to patreon.com/itsthereal. It is a very easy way to contribute toward keeping this going, moving forward, building, and for us to keep amplifying the best people and the best stories that are out there. And with that, Jeff, when do you want to get into this podcast?
Right now.
Yo, what up? It's Eric, a.k.a. Breastfeeding, a.k.a. Bottle Service.
Yo, what up? It's Jeff, a.k.a. NYPD, a.k.a. Brick Squad.
Yo, what up? It's Calmatic, a.k.a. 5 Foot Assassin, a.k.a. 310, a.k.a. What was Spike Rumor Spike Lee, dude. Rumor Spike Jones, dude. Shit, man, you caught me off guard, dog.
Get it cracking.
What's up, man?
Yes, your third favorite podcast to waste time with. It's the real.
Man,
Cal,
bro,
what's happening?
Like, you know what's funny, man? I swear to God, dog. Like, I've been listening to you guys' podcast for, like, maybe, I don't know how long, like, maybe 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
And I was like, yo, one day I'm going to be on the show, and I'm going to kill the AKA. And, and I just realized that that was my moment. And I kind of fumbled it, but it's all good, because one day we're going to do it in person, dog, and
that's
I'm
right.
just, like, smash it. So
there we go.
It's all good, man.
There we go. Yo, Cal, first of all, how is your heart? How is your soul? How is your being right now?
I mean, to be honest, man, like, I've been telling people, like, this isn't anything new. I think what's new is the overwhelming, like, spotlight that's on it, and it doesn't feel like, you know, we're in control of it. And so it's a tough thing to navigate, because obviously, like, the support feels good, but it's just like I'm looking at it with a side eye, because I'm like, how long is this going to last?
Yeah.
I've seen this before, you know what I'm saying? And then even with, you know, the creative community, you know, I think it's interesting that, you know, we all feel like we have to do something, to say something. And I've struggled with that, because, like, deep down inside, I feel like, you know, I'm trying to find a way to, like, do it based on my aesthetic and my, like, you know, branding. And I just feel like it's disingenuous once you start to bring those elements into it. So I've just been kind of frozen. I've been like, you know, I don't know what to do. And to be honest, I'm just confused, man. Like, I don't know what to do. You know what I mean? It, like I said, this is nothing new. And I don't know when it's going to stop. I don't know if it's going to stop after this, or I don't know if it's going to take another 50, 100 years, but this is not it.
Yeah, I mean, like, I feel like the same sort of way I felt 4 or 5 years ago when Black Lives Matter as a movement first sort of came together. And it was just like, you felt so optimistic, like white people were finally listening. And then there are some people who are still with the movement and do that every day. And there are some people who treat it sort of like reggaeton, where it was like, it was a moment. And then, like, it'll come back when, like, Justin Bieber hops on, you know, like,
right.
It's exactly. It's a very weird thing to get, like, optimistic about.
And it's so funny, too, because, you know, obviously I've been getting the text messages and the phone calls of, like, the are you okays, you know, like, somebody just texted me, or a white person texted me, are you safe and sound? And I'm just like, you know, and it's funny because I purposely ignored those texts.
Right.
And then he, maybe like 2 days later, doubled down and said, hey, are you guys safe and sound? And I'm like, yo, if I wasn't, I probably would be dead by now, because you didn't check in or didn't call. So, like, do you really care? You know what I'm saying? And then, you know, when people are saying, like, oh, what's going on right now? It's so crazy. It's like, yo, this has been going on. Like, you know what I mean? And also, tell me what's going on. Don't just say what's going on. Say what's happening, because I don't even think a lot of people really, really understand what's really happening. I think they just see the police fighting the protests, and they assume that that's happening to us, but it's deeper than that. You know, it's all the microaggressions that we experience on a daily basis. So, you know, it's not just the protest that's the weird part. It's just everyday life.
Yeah. So we are, what, like 3 or 4 months? It's hard to tell time anymore, but 3 or 4 months since, I think, basically everything shut down for the pandemic. And then, you know, the last 10 days has been very intense. You mentioned yourself as a creator not knowing how to put work out there or what your vision is. Has this carried on for the last 3 months, 4 months as well?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think it's interesting. I think, you know, obviously at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, I did what a lot of people probably did. I bought a keyboard. I bought, like, a fucking punch needle knitting set. I just did, like, all this. I just like bought all these, like, random hobbyist things.
Yeah, you were thinking, just searching, like, for anything.
I bought a puzzle that I put together. Like, I just bought everything, and I'm sitting down 3 months later, and I still haven't learned how to play the piano. I still, you know, I haven't moved past these 4 pieces on the puzzle, and it's just, you know, but
how hard is the puzzle?
But it's hard. It's actually like 1,000. and a 1,000-piece set of the moon. So it's just like a bunch of gray spots. Anyway, but the one thing that I have been doing is like playing a bunch of NBA 2K.
Yeah.
And just like chilling and just allowing myself to just like be the carefree artist that I was before things were serious and just let inspiration come to me and like live life and, you know, raising my, you know, 6-month son and just like not really putting pressure on myself. And I feel like, you know, that's when the most inspiration happens, not when I like force myself to like learn how to play I'm different on a keyboard. You know what I'm saying? So
for the record, by the way, when we would go to our aunt's place down in Washington, she has a piano at her place. And yeah, when I'm Different came out, for sure, we thought we were like Mustard just like tapping on the keys and figuring it out ourselves.
We thought we were geniuses.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, man. So I've been trying to, you know, study the works of Mustard along with Mozart. So.
Yeah. Cal, I think that there's a lot of people who know you for your visual work. Do you consider yourself more of a sort of like more general storyteller where it's not the medium per se, but it's like who you are?
Yeah, man. I mean, that's what my goal has always been, but it just so happened that certain things have kind of taken over. You know, obviously, like, I don't know if you guys know, but I started off as a producer. And then, you know, that led to me rapping. You know, I put out a mixtape and then, you know, but I was always kind of like the computer nerd. So, you know, I started doing graphic design for all my rapper friends and doing photo shoots and MySpace layouts.
Right, for like Casey Veggies and...
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I did Casey Veggies' first album cover. I did Dom Kennedy's first album cover. Like, I did like an early... I did a big article for Madbury Club where we like focused on like the future of LA music. And that featured like Kendrick Lamar, Tyler Creator, you know, all these like LA rappers that were just like my homies and my, you know, peers in the music scene. And it just so happened that, you know, I stumbled into a camera and I started filming. So it's just like, yeah, I can't really control what takes over at any given moment, but, you know, I still do graphic design. I still design websites. I still do my own art aside from film. So I'm just, you know, I just want to be like, you know, the ultimate Renaissance man, you know what I'm saying, times 10. So.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the very, very beginning. You're West Coast all the way. Where are you originally from?
Man, so I'm born and raised in South Central / Inglewood, Los Angeles, California. I grew up on a couple of different blocks, 99th and Prairie in Inglewood, Sanella and La Brea in Inglewood, Florence and Normandy in South Central. And now I'm in like, you know, like the Slauson Crenshaw district, Slauson and La Brea.
And so what's it like growing up there and what's the temperature like? You know, how is it to grow up there? Do you have any siblings? What'd your folks do? All that.
So, I mean, I think it's pretty like it's interesting, man. I think like I've always said this growing up, like L.A., there's a bunch of like borderlines. You know what I'm saying? Like you could live in one neighborhood, but right across the street, it would be a whole completely different vibe.
Yeah.
And so I've always lived on the edge, you know what I'm saying? So where I live, where I usually stay would be like a more family-centered side with a bunch of like working class families, kids my age running around playing sports. Sports is super, you know, prominent out here. Like everyone plays basketball, everyone plays football on the weekends. But then right across the street is where all the gangbangers are. You know what I'm saying? And so I had friends from both sides. So I couldn't really go across the street, but I could look over there and see like, damn, some shit is going down over there. You know what I mean? And that's kind of been true to like my life in general, everywhere that I've lived. You know, my dad was born and raised in South Central. My mom was born and raised in South Central. My mom was a hairdresser. My dad is a musician. And I have a younger sister who's an artist and as well. So, you know, it's just like a semi-creative family. I mean, we're all creative in our own endeavors, but it's more of like a very, it's more like a hobbyist thing versus like a professional, you know, creativity.
Yeah. So did you have dreams of sticking around in Los Angeles when you were in, you know, elementary school, middle school, or did you like want to, you know, move to New York or Paris or somewhere else?
Nah, man, I think that's the thing about LA, man. It's like people don't realize like everything is here. Like I know when I was a little bit like once I started getting heavily into hip hop, I wanted to visit Brooklyn and all that good stuff. And I remember my first trip to to New York, I actually went to Williamsburg, like, right before it got gentrified, and I was like, yo, this is, like, the most inspirational place in the world. There's graffiti everywhere. It looks like the music videos.
Yo, the fact that you said that you went to Williamsburg before it became Williamsburg is the most Williamsburg thing you could possibly say.
But it was, like, right, I forgot what year it was, but it was, like, right, where you could see some stuff getting like, gentrified, but not really. But just even the aesthetic of it, like this is like, you know, me coming from LA and like experiencing Silver Lake and,
yeah.
and Echo Park. It was like, oh, this is the New York version, but it has bridges and it seems more authentic here. But anyway, you know, and then after that, I was like, you know, this is fine. But once I came back to LA, I was like, man, everything is here. Like, you know, I don't need to go anywhere. There's the beach, there's celebrities, there's the industry, there's like the hood shit, there's like, you know, beautiful people, there's community. Like, I never, like, I tell my wife probably hates hearing this, but like, I don't want to live anywhere else. Like, if I got rich, I would probably buy a crib in Hawaii or something, but I'm not, I can't see myself living anywhere else but Los Angeles.
Yeah. Well, how did you differentiate yourself growing up? Like, or did you fall into like the mix where it's just like, oh, that's the cool way to dress, or that's the, you know, cool thing to listen to. You know, you can go with that.
Man, you know what? That's a good question, dog. Cause I've always felt like, you know, I'm sure everyone does, but I've always felt like kind of like an outcast. Like I never was like the cool kid. I was always the person that was with the cool kids. And so, you know, I didn't have enough attention on me to like really care about how I was presenting myself or what, you know, what my quote unquote aesthetic was. So that kind of allowed me to just be myself and not have to worry about, you know, someone judging me. And so, I don't know. I think I just kind of, you know, gravitated more towards the, I don't even know how you describe it, but like the vintage, Afrocentric, vintage, underground hip hop, and live doing. I don't even, to be honest, I'm probably confusing myself. I don't know what it is, but I feel like it was always just kind of left of center of what everyone else was doing. But ultimately, those things came back around to me and made me feel like I was validated in my decisions to, you know, how I represented myself, you know, visually.
Yeah, I mean, like, well, what did you want to be as a kid?
Man, I wanted to be a baseball player, man. You know, I grew up playing baseball. Like, my whole entire life was centered around baseball. You know, I played here in the inner city, and, you know, our little league team was, like, when I was 12 years old, like, we were, like ranked, like, one of the top teams in the nation.
Wow.
And we went to go play in tournaments. You know, there's a couple guys that were on my team that ended up playing in the MLB. And, you
really?
Know, I just think, like, we were really out there, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think, like the team that beat us went to the Little League World Series, you know what I'm saying?
Damn.
And so it's interesting because I was a baseball guy my whole entire life. And then once I got to college, you know, I tried to, like, walk on to the college baseball team, and they were like, who the fuck are you? Like, we don't know who you are. You can't try out.
Really?
And so I ended up taking a job as like a coach's assistant or like an equipment manager. And it was like the most, like, it was the most hurtful thing that I've ever done to myself in my life. Like, just like going from, like, you know, an all league, you know, all star baseball player to, like, you know, thinking I'm going to walk on this team
to just being completely next, like, know, treated, you know, like dog shit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And not necessarily treated like dog shit, but just like, you know, we're playing against other teams and I'm seeing kids that I played with, you know, and they're actually on the other team, but I'm like, you know, holding the baseballs for the hitting coach. And I'm just like, ooh, I can't do this, man. And so that's what made me, you know, say goodbye to baseball and then focus on, you know, the music side, which I had been playing with, you know, throughout high school.
Well, okay, so what position did you play mostly in baseball?
Man, so when I was younger, I was a catcher.
Yeah.
So obviously, I'm a pretty short guy. I'm only like 5'4". And so when I was younger, I was able to be a catcher. But once I got to, you know, the next level, like high school, I remember I went to this, like, this baseball clinic, and this guy was just like, you're too short to be a fucking catcher. Go to second base. And I was like, fuck, I don't want to play second. And so I just went to second because they told me I'd never be a catcher. And so I ended up playing second for the most of my latter career in high school. So I don't know, man. Like, I like to say I'm a second baseman, but to be honest, man, like, I don't have a position I prefer. I could pretty much play any position.
Yeah, I think there's, I think that I love baseball. There's such a beauty in it. And I think that's, you know, lost a lot on this current generation where, you know, people want fast action and can't take nine innings or sit in there, you know, enjoying it. But like, so catcher is someone obviously who runs the game. I think there's like obviously a lot there for you as a director, as somebody who is a leader. I think you can see the correlation there. But also there's a beauty in playing second base because the interaction with the shortstop and like when you turn to, I think there's you know, like so when you were playing baseball, were you like all the way in where you had like your batting gloves in your back pocket? Were you chewing sunflower seeds the whole thing?
Yeah, the whole thing. I just ordered a glove like maybe a couple of weeks ago. Like when I ordered my piano and my punch needle kit, I ordered a baseball glove as well.
Love that.
I was like, I need a glove. But yeah, I was definitely all into it. I was baseball, like I was ball is life baseball guy, like 1,000%. Like, you know, I didn't see it any other way. Even to the point where when I got to college, I majored in kinesiology in hopes that I would. In hopes that I would get my degree in kinesiology and go back to high school and coach,
Right.
coach baseball.
Right.
And I feel like it's like one of the, you know, I sucked at math, so I couldn't really get that degree. And it's one of the best things that ever happened to me because I always tell people, like, if I stuck with baseball, I feel like I'd probably be like some random, you know, dude that like lives in Arizona and has like a white wife. And like listens and like thinks like J. Cole is the greatest rapper of all time, and I just wouldn't have any kind of like swag. So I'm glad it didn't work out.
So you ended up going to college, and you thought kinesiology was your way. Where did you go to school?
I went to CSUN, Cal State Northridge, which is like in the Valley.
Yeah, yeah.
And to be honest, like I didn't finish. Like I said, I went there for the first couple of years. For kinesiology, and I just like failed out of every class. Like I couldn't pass statistics, didn't care about biology or any of that shit. So
I mean, you said you're not good at math, so
yeah,
yeah, yeah. So I pivoted to an art major with one of my best friends. He was doing graphic design for a major, so I just joined him and we started taking classes together. But ultimately, you know, I started making more money, you know, doing flyers and mixtape covers, and you know. Yeah, and I realized like it wasn't any point in me going to school anymore, so I dropped out.
Well, was that your first like job? Because I mean, like I know that like baseball can take up a lot of time. Like we said, like there's nine innings.
yeah, man.
And also just like practices and shit. But like, what was your first job like as a kid?
Man, I mean that's funny. Yeah, you're right about baseball taking up a lot of time. I tell people all the time, like in high school, I didn't go to parties. Like I didn't hang out like the typical kids doing the movies. Like I was playing games every weekend, travel teams, tournaments, all that kind of shit.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had one job when I was in high school, and it was just like a very like random office clerk position at my mom's job, which is like this at the VA hospital. And basically my job was to, so basically every year they sent out a letter to every employee telling them like their status and like how much they get paid for the following year. And this is before, you know, everyone had computer generated things. So I had to sit on a typewriter and type everyone's name and address on envelopes and then stuff the envelope. And I was maybe about 15 when I did that. And that was my job every day. And I got bored with that shit. And so I just started writing raps. I literally would go on, what is that website? Official Hip Hop Lyric Archive.
Oh yeah, OHLA. Yeah, absolutely.
And just like download like PD Pop, PD Crack freestyles.
Yo, or, by the way, like, I wish you downloaded PD Pablo freestyles.
Yeah, just download like PD Crack freestyles. And wow. And just like rewrote them on my paper and then like switched out a few words to make it more personal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you know, and now like I have my own rap. So that's what kind of started my rap career.
Wait, did you quote unquote like freestyle in terms of like instant messaging somebody and like hitting them that way? Or did you go to like boards and you would like put it up there? Or did you actually like in real life like battle against people?
I didn't battle against people in real life. I had one battle. I mean, this is a long story. I don't want to go too deep into it, but just know no one at my high school knew that I could rap until the last day of school, where the known rapper was in a cipher, and I went into the cipher and battled him and like beat and won.
Yo,
and
that was like, is a movie right there.
And everybody was like, "Yo, what the fuck? Like, are you drunk? You know?" What I'm saying? Like, I was just like. people thought I was just like, they had no clue I was a rapper. But
that's wild.
As far as battling, I was on message boards. Yeah, I was on Nike Talk. I was on all that shit. Like, just like not even rapping, not even battling, but just like typing out like 4 bars every now and then, just like, you know, whatever the fuck we used to do back then. I don't know.
Well, okay, so number one, did your parents have any idea that you had musical aspirations like that?
Well, so it's funny because I started off making beats, right? Like, yeah. You know, I became obsessed with Little Brother, and I found out that Ninth Wonder made beats on Fruity Loops.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had a friend who was a neighbor, and I don't know how he had this shit, because he wasn't even a producer, but he had a bootleg copy of Fruity Loops on disc. And he just gave it to me, and I started making beats. So my parents would always see me on a computer making beats, but they had no clue that I rapped. You know what I mean? Like, I put out a whole mixtape, I put out songs, and like, they had no clue that I rapped. Even to this day, like, they kind of don't really know about that part. But
do they listen to this podcast? Because they're about to find out. You know? Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, they definitely have heard me say this, but like, I don't think they've actually like dove in to like listen to my actual raps, which are kind of embarrassing at this point.
What was that conversation like when you did tell your parents that you were no longer gonna go to school?
Man, it's crazy because I think at the time, like, it was around like 2008, where like the economy was going down, and you know, I was going to class less and less, and it sucked because my dad, you know, I would be in my room on a computer, and my dad would like go to work and he would see me on a computer, and then he'd come back home, you know, 9 hours later, and I'd still be on a computer. And so he was like, man, what the fuck are you doing? Like, are you actually doing anything? Like, are you just sitting around a computer? But he didn't know when he left that I was going around the city connecting with different rappers, doing mixtape covers, taking pictures, and then coming back and being on a computer again. And so it was hard for him to actually see that I was actually making money and like making and like starting to make a career doing video and graphic design stuff. And it wasn't until I started making money to where he kind of, you know, settled down as far as like forcing me to do stuff. Like at one point he kind of, I don't want to say forced, because I feel like that feels a little bit tougher than what it was, but he made me go down to the post office and apply to be a mailman.
Yeah.
And I went through the whole process, but for some reason, to this day, I don't know why, but I failed the driving test.
Really?
Yeah, and it wasn't like we drove on one of those, like, you know, those mail trucks that had, like...
But that's the whole point.
The steering wheel on the opposite
on the other side,
side?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, it was just like a regular, like, car, but, you know, they told me that I failed the test, and I was like, I don't know how I failed the test, but fuck it, like, I guess. And you know, if it wasn't for me failing the test, I would probably just be a mailman right now.
Wow.
Well, I mean, or yeah. What about the time that you were a park ranger?
Oh, yeah, I mean, that was after that. So, yeah, I mean, I worked at this this walking trail in LA called the Baldwin Hills Scenic Overlook. There's just like a state ran park that has a bunch of nature, but pretty much people just come there to work out. It's like Runyon Canyon. It's like if someone said I'm a park ranger at Runyon Canyon. and so at the top of the hill, when everybody, like, you know, does their workout, there's like a history museum facility. I used to work there, and so I used to always think people were coming in to like get a tour of the land or, you know, learn more about the space. But then they would always ask me like, "Yo, is there a restroom here? do you guys sell water? You know what I mean?" And like, or like, "What's this?" But luckily, you know, I've always had these jobs where, you know, I was able to practice on my craft, like, on the side without, you know, any repercussions. So, you know, while I was there all day, no one came into the museum. So I would just sit on my computer all day and work on graphic design, make beats, work on, you know, video editing and all that kind of shit. So,
well, talk to us about that time in terms of what blogs and websites you were absolutely on all the time.
Man, to be honest, like, it's so funny that you're asking me this, because I think, you know, what stopped me from rapping is I started to get a bunch of anxiety about rapping. You know what I mean? It was a weird time where, like, you know, blog rap was, like, at its height, and I wasn't really making any waves. And so I was seeing other artists, you know, being featured on certain blogs, and it would really give me anxiety. So it was times where I couldn't go on these websites because it made me so mad. And I think it's so funny to talk about it in hindsight, but like, you know, obviously it's like the Two Dope Boys,
yep.
You know, the hiphopgame.com.
Yeah.
You know, what else? Like, I mean, you name it, dog. Like,
not
I,
right. Like, Misinfo.
I was on all those
yeah.
blogs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think what's funny is what actually, you know, kind of, you know, helped me get through that phase was a website was undergroundhiphop.com.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you guys remember that site, but you could actually buy CDs or vinyl off of the website, but they had an option where you could preview the song, and instead of it being like a 30-second clip, it was the whole entire song. And so it was like streaming before streaming.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that's how I discovered Little Brother. That's how I discovered, you know, MERS and a bunch of underground hip hop artists, just by going to those sites and just listening to those songs during my downtime at work. And that's what kind of made me pivot to a different style of hip hop that wasn't, you know, centered around these blogs and this like weird, like, you know, game of who can get put on the blogs in LA, and I couldn't handle that shit anymore, man.
So are you saying that the anxiety came from you not being on the same level as an artist, or not getting the same look as an artist, or not having the same sound as an artist?
It was a little bit of everything. I think it was like, you know, it was kind of the same energy that Tyler the Creator had towards, you know, all those blogs.
Yeah,
of like,
Two Dope
you know,
Boys. Yeah.
Where he would reach out.
And the thing is, like, I was cool with those guys. Like, I ended up being cool with those guys at those blogs, like, over time. Like, I mean, there's so many blogs. Remember, like, what was it? Like, what was the New York one?
Real Talk New York.
Yeah.
Real Talk New York and all that kind of shit. Like, you know what I mean? I ended up not right, like, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But it was a phase where I was like, man, what can I do to be featured more prominently? Like, what can I do? And I'm sending emails and I'm doing all this shit, but I'm never getting posted. Meanwhile, I'm seeing other rappers get posted. I'm like, man, what do they have that I don't have? You know what I mean? And so every day it would be like waking up and seeing like, okay, let's see who's on it now. You know what I mean? And that just became like just tiresome for no reason, you know?
Did you have your own Tumblr?
Oh yeah, eventually, yeah. But I definitely had a Tumblr later down the road. But I think by the time I got the Tumblr, I wasn't into music. I was more just like into photography and focusing more on my video direction.
Right. Well, I mean, like, how did you how did you get your first camera?
Man, it's a crazy story. So, so me and my boy, we started this graphic design company where we did album covers. So we would do like a full service thing where we'd do a photo shoot, an album cover, and a MySpace design. Like that was our whole package. And so we bought like a little small Canon Rebel TI, a little small entry level camera. And we had that for a while. And, you know, at the time, I was thinking about music videos, but you had to have, like, those big old, like, you know, video cameras that had tape. And, like, there was no way I could afford to get one of those cameras. And so, you know, I focused on photography. And then, you know, one day, I went to go get my window fixed because someone broke into my car. And when I came back home, my window in my room was broken.
Huh.
And I looked up and I was like, yo, someone just broke into my house and stole everything. I'm looking around the room and I don't see anything. My TV is gone. My computers are gone. My camera is gone. My musical equipment is gone. Everything is gone. So someone broke into my crib and stole everything.
Fuck.
And so, you know, my mom, so it's funny. So then right after that, it was like a downtime where I didn't have anything. I didn't have a computer, didn't have anything to be creative. And I randomly got invited to a Kanye West music video shoot. And that Kanye West video, I'm sorry, I don't know if you can hear my kid in the background.
No, all good.
He's crying. Okay, so I'm sorry, that music video was Spike Jonze directed. It was the See You in My Nightmares music video. And it was Kanye.
Which is like 12 minutes long. It's, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a mini movie. It's very not good.
it's very not good. But when I was there, I was an extra, right? And I was in that scene. There was a
You're
hallway
in it?
Scene where he got... Yeah, I'm in it. So there's a hallway scene where Kanye is like drunk and he's walking around and he's like being rude and like bumping into people and he starts a fight. And so I'm in that scene. And so when I was in, when I was there that day, Spike Jonze was directing with the Canon 5D. And I was like, yo, you can do video on that camera? And he was like, yeah, man, this is like the new thing. Like, check it out. Like, and so he let me look at it. And I was like, yo, I have to get this. And so maybe a couple of days later, my mom was like, all right, so just to let you know, we have renter's insurance so we can replace your camera. So what kind of camera did you have?
Instead of
telling her I had a Canon Rebel, I told her I had a Canon 7D.
Don't admit to insurance fraud on our podcast.
No, so it's funny because I've been telling the story for a while, and I was like, I think I reached the statute of limitations like a long time ago. But anyway, it was funny because they said all you have to do was have like a receipt or like a brochure. So I like went online and just found like a PDF of a brochure and said like, this is my brochure. So now, you know, instead of having my Dell that could barely hold a charge or my Canon TI that had no video, I got a brand new 70 and a brand new MacBook Pro. And so now instead of just taking pictures, I'm doing video.
Holy shit.
Yo, you gotta like thank your partner for breaking into your room and stealing all your stuff.
Man, that's the funny thing. Like, it's so funny because I feel like I know exactly who broke into my house, but I'm afraid to ask him because I feel like it'll make him feel so awkward.
Oh my god!
I don't know him.
Yes,
I don't know him personally, but I feel like it was that guy for sure.
Yo, so you get this camera.
Wait, before we get onto that, what qualities does this person have that you think that they might have broken into your room?
I mean, they always say, like, whenever someone breaks into your house, it's more than likely someone you know.
You know, I just feel
like it was that. So basically, I was out when I was producing, I would have a bunch of rappers come to my house to, like, listen to beats. And maybe a week before someone broke into my house, this one guy came to, like, listen to beats. And I was just like, if it was anybody that I know, it was him for sure.
Wow.
But, you know, it is what it is. Thank, like, good looking out, bro.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
who you are.
Your music career has, you know, paid off tenfold.
but Cal, so,
exactly.
So being on set with Spike Jonze, who you just listed as one of your, you know, inspirations, and getting to talk to him, or at least even be around him and watch him work, like, what did that mean to you?
Man, at the time, like, I think I kind of took it for granted, man, because I didn't really, like, I knew the name Spike Jonze, but I didn't really know, like, when I was at that shoot, I didn't really know how cool it was that it was Spike Jonze. Like, to me, he was just, like, some random white dude, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't really make the correlation that he was Spike Jonze, who's made some of my favorite music videos and commercials until a lot later, you know what I'm saying? So, but it was just cool to see how free he was, and it's funny because now, when you look at the way he directs now, you know, the way he shot some of those Kanye videos on iPhones, or, you know, the way he's like ripping and running with cameras and, you know, is very just kind of like skater about his approach as a director. Like, it definitely was on display that day. And it kind of inspired me to just, you know, do it whenever I get a camera, to do it how I want to do it.
Yeah. So you do get that 7D, and Does having the camera make you a music video director?
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's funny because, you know, basically at the time I was producing and, you know, rapping with this group called Overdose, and they were just like my childhood friends. And so we would always be in the studio. And so, you know, one day when I came back with the camera, I'm just like, all right, so, like, let's just make a beat or, like, let's just make a song and I'll film it. And so I just started becoming, like, their unofficial videographer. And then it was like, all right, well, it's time to shoot a music video. And so we just went out. And luckily, we didn't have shit to do. So we would just spend all of our summer days just, like, shooting a music video. You know, we would spend, you know, almost 3 weeks, day in, day out, shooting one music video. And then next thing you know, we're presenting a video with, like, 100 scenes in it. And people were like, how the fuck did you guys do this? And it's like, We just took our time and just, like, did, you know, one thing a day for, like, a whole month. So, you know, it was definitely a bunch of trial and error, but they were super creative and super down to do whatever. So it allowed me to explore all types of effects and in turn and then ultimately, like, creating my own style.
Yeah, well, what's one music video or one aesthetic or one, you know, feature film that you really looked to at that time that you were like, yo, I want to make my shit, like, in that lane?
I don't know, man. It's tough because I think there was a lot of inspirations inspired, like, my first couple of videos. I think obviously it's the Busta Rhymes, Missy Elliott, you know, that genre of music video. But then I don't know, man. I think it was just like, to be honest, I don't know what my experience was. I mean, my inspirations were. I think it was just like, let's just go and shoot some shit and like figure it out. And I think my built-in instincts from just watching, you know, The Box and MTV growing up just kind of like spilled out creatively as I went on. You know what I'm saying? There was no reference point at all, except for like, let's just do something.
Yeah. So Jeff and I, you know, started out way back when doing sketches every Monday for 3.5 years. So we would like, you know, run around all of New York City to try to find like a different look and a different style every Monday. We never wanted to do like the same setup and the same thing over and over. We just wanted to give you something new. Did you use Los Angeles to its full extent when you were like really running and gunning?
Yeah, man, I think the thing is like, obviously, like, being from L.A., like, L.A. is interesting because I feel like at the time I was making videos, L.A. wasn't really in vogue. Like, obviously, like, you know, during the early West Coast hip-hop days, we had a big run, and it was like L.A., L.A., L.A. But then, like, you know, obviously the South took over, and even before that, it was a very New York, you know, centered thing. And so people, you know, weren't really, you know, flocking to L.A. So
yeah, it was sort of like open. Williamsburg before Williamsburg.
Yeah, exactly. It's like L.A. before L.A., you know what I mean? Like, it's like, you know, like Slauson and Crenshaw wasn't like a
destination,
a landmark, right. A destination. You know what I mean? It was like, this is where we go get our haircuts at.
Yeah.
This is where that guy, that tall Etrian guy sells incense. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, like this is our backyard. And so, you know, growing up, like I was a very observant, you know, kid, and there's a lot of places and landmarks that, you know, stuck in my brain of like cool looking places, like, you know, whether it be like the Crenshaw Wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, man, no one's used this Crenshaw Wall for a video shoot since Boys in the Hood. Let's film a scene there. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Leimert Park, where Moesha does her title sequence dance, like no one's shot there in a while, and it's right here. Let's shoot a scene there. You know what I mean? Like, I know the street where they shot Boys in the Hood. I know the street where blah blah blah. Let's go use these same areas and kind of give them new life and kind of show the world where we live and how we do it and how it's regular to us and not just like some, you know, some movie set. You know what I mean? Like, this is our real lives.
Yeah. Did you shoot anything on the Baldwin Hills trails?
You know, it's funny. I feel like I used to do, man, I used to hustle out of that spot, bro. So I used to do headshots there. So basically, like, if I would, like, talk to, like, up-and-coming actors, and if they needed headshots, I would go do, like, headshots, like, in the trails.
Yeah.
So, like, we would find, like, a nice little, like, cactus or, like, a nice, like, you know, bushy area, and there'd just be, like, me in a park ranger shoot, like, a park ranger suit, doing, like, a full-on photo shoot with, like, a wannabe actor. But, yeah, so, I mean, no music videos. I think I probably have done some there, but no music videos, but mainly just like on the side, bootleg headshot photos.
Who was the first person that like came up to you or reached out to you after like seeing one of your videos and was like, wow, like you just did something special from outside your circle?
Man, I don't know. I think the first couple of music videos I did, people didn't know that it was me because they still saw me as a rapper.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever they, cause I went by a certain name and then I did my music videos under Calmatic, and people were like, who is Calmatic? Like, what's Calmatic? And I think once people started to realize it was me, they would be like, yo, like, what the fuck, bro? You did this? Like, who is Calmatic? You and who else? And I was like, nah, that's just me, man. And so I think like, just like my other, like all my peers musically just started to like take me a little serious on the visual side, and I think that was when I felt, you know, a lot more comfortable and validated that what I was doing was working.
Yeah, well, if you're somebody who, you know, as a musician was, you know, anxious about people's responses or your ability to get your shit like out there,
did you feel the same way as a filmmaker?
Well, yeah, and did you read comments on YouTube?
Man, I mean, definitely, like, at the beginning, I definitely read comments, and luckily, I never really got any bad comments on any of my videos. Like, to be real, like, I don't know if that's a bragging point, but, like, most of my videos are pretty good to the point where, like, they're not, like, embarrassingly bad, you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
I definitely have gotten my fair share of like, oh, you're a genius, and I take those, you know, with a grain of salt. But you know, it's not like, I don't know. I love public opinion. You know what I mean? But you know, I try not to get too, you know, deep into it, because you know, they say you're not as good as they say you are. You're not as bad as they say you
sure.
are.
Sure. You know, well, I love public opinion when they agree with me.
Yeah, exactly. Like every now and then, you get somebody that's like, this shit is whack, and it's like, bro, you're clearly lying. Like this shit is not whack. Like this shit is one of the coolest things you've ever seen. So shut up.
So you had that SLR and you're running around with it. What's the first like big budget that's, or bigger budget that comes your way and you're just like, oh shit, like this is like a real thing now?
Yeah, any budget.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, like I did, so there's a bunch of overdose videos that I did for like the first few years of my career, and like I probably got paid $20 for all of those combined. You know what I'm saying? Right. Like I did it all for the free. It was all homies. And then, you know, they eventually got signed to a label, and it was the first time that I actually, you know, did a video with a budget. And it was actually, I don't know, it's an interesting thing. I'm actually going to go back real quick. So at that point, I was the guy who was like bringing in the cameras, doing the lighting, doing all my editing, doing every single, you know, part of the video. And then I got hit up by Vic Mensa. And Vic Mensa was like, yo, man, we actually met Vic Mensa in Chicago when we went to Lollapalooza. And he was like, yo, I love you guys' videos. We should work on something. And Vic Mensa got signed and he came out to L.A. and he wanted to do a video. And so he reached out to me and he was like, yo, man, you want to do a video? And I was like, hell yeah, bro. I got you, man. It's nothing. And so he was like, all right, I'm going to hook you up with these producers and they're going to produce the video. And so this is my first time working with producers. You know, first time I'm coming on set and I don't have to have the camera.
Wow.
They have a red camera. They have a camera operator. They have, you know, Crafty, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like the whole nine, like a location, look like everything. And, you know, I directed the video. The video came out really clean. And I remember hitting up the producer like, yo, what's up with my payment? And he was like, oh, Vic told me that you were going to do it for free. Yeah. He told me that you said it's nothing.
You
know? And I was like, oh no! And it's funny because I ended up not getting paid at all for that video.
Yeah.
But that was my first time working with a big crew, working with a assistant director, working with producers, and I learned so much. And so I just chalked it up to the game, like, all right, even though I didn't get paid, like I learned a lot, and I used a lot of that experience to help me do my future productions.
Well, yeah, and well, how was it to go from basically working on your own to working in a bigger group, and like,
yeah, how do you learn how to delegate?
I mean, I don't know, it's interesting, man. I think it all depends on who you're working with. I think, you know, I didn't really understand what a DP was. I didn't understand what a assistant director was, you know what I mean? And then once I started to, like, you know, work more and more in that style, I started to see, like, what makes a difference in your actual final product. You know, I would always look at a bunch of, you know, Eurocentric or European, you know, music videos and wonder, like, man, how is there, like, why is their video have, like, this blue tint to it? Like, why does it have this, like, really cool look to it? Is it the lens? Is it the lighting? And then I learned about color correction, you know what I'm saying? And I'm just like, oh, it's color correction. So now I need a good colorist so my shit can look like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Now I need a good DP because this DP knows what lenses to use to give that soft light, to get that soft look versus that super sharp world star look that I'm tired of looking at. You know what I mean? And so I think over time you just start to learn little by little what makes a complete product, and you start to like know how to look at people's reels, know how to look at DP's portfolio and say, okay, I want this guy because I can see he understands this part of the filmmaking process that is going to make, that it's going to allow me to achieve my look.
How involved are you with the edit? Like, do you like to sit with the editor like the full time and go through from like every single take, or do you want a cut to come to you and then you get involved?
So listen, man, I don't, neither one of those. I edit my own stuff.
All right.
I edit all of my music videos. I don't edit my commercials because that's a whole nother headache that I don't want to deal with. But all my music videos, I take pride in editing all of them. You know, I you know, based on necessity, when I started doing music videos, I had to edit my own stuff, and I fell in love with the process, you know what I'm saying? And I always tell people, like, you know, I look at editing as if I was the same way I look at making beats, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not editing on, like, the drums and, like, the perfect, you know, snaps of the song. You know, I'm like if J Dilla was a editor, you know, yeah, what I'm saying? I'm like the MF Doom right of editing. Behind, yeah, I'm like the Mad Lib of editing, where like I find the off beats and I find the weird ways to like make you feel kind of uncomfortable, but it's actually in sync with an internal clock that you don't even realize exists. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And so yeah, man, it's really been hard for me to step away from editing. You know, I think the more high profile my jobs get, the more picky the clients are when it comes to the edit, and that's something that I don't want to deal with. So I've been slowly but surely, you know, giving editing jobs to other people. But you know, I edited 99% of my, you know, my music videos.
When Vic Mensa brought you onto that first job, and he was at a label, you know, I know that labels, and also just like any company, is very not suspicious, but like a little hesitant to picking up new talent and bringing them in. And so, like, was there a conversation where it was like, yeah, like, you want to do it, but, like, we have somebody who's more experienced?
Well, yeah, so I think, so the thing about the Vic Mensa thing is he was signed to, like, an independent label, so, like, he had total control. But I think it was an interesting thing when the group Overdose that I was working with, when we got signed to RCA, you know, it was time to shoot a music video, and you know, we made sure that when we signed the deal that they knew that I was a part of that package.
Mm-hmm.
We let it be known, like, from the front that, like, I'm damn near, like, the fifth member of the group, where, like, you know, I'm doing the music videos, I'm overlooking all the creativity, and this is the way it's going to be. So every now and then, someone who didn't know that would be like, hey, do you guys want to work with this other director? Like, do you want to work with this guy? And it was always a no. This is who we're going to work with. And, you know, luckily they held on to that and allowed me to, like, grow, you know, while they were growing.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of people, like we were talking about before, who consider Los Angeles in a couple of different time periods. And clearly, you know, that 90s LA look, that 90s LA feel, and that 90s LA sound is by itself and just a monster. So when you think about the last 10 years and you think about the sound and the feel and the look, do you, you know, put yourself right there with the Tylers and like the Kendricks and the Mac Millers and the, you know, everyone who lives out there, works out there and created this movement that is now a monster in itself? Do you put yourself in there as well?
Yeah, I mean, it was tough. It was tough to find, to like realize that. But I think I did, like, that didn't come. That wasn't apparent until this newer generation, these kids that are like 24, 23 and younger now, are starting to come up to me and they're like, yo, bro, like, you're the GOAT.
Yeah.
Like, you're like when I was in fourth grade, like, I saw Overdose video and it changed my life. You know, there's a bunch of artists. It's so funny because obviously Overdose, like, they're, you know, no longer active, but every now and then a different artist that's actually mainstream right now comes out the woodworks and it's like, yo, y'all remember Overdose? Overdose was the shit. Like, I think Made in Tokyo just came out recently and was like, yo, man, like, this video changed my life. And it was like an Overdose video from 2010. You know what I'm saying?
Wow.
There's a bunch of people that were extremely, you know, inspired by our creativity. And it's hard to see that while you're in it. You know, I mean, like, while we were in it, we were just always trying to find ways to make cool videos. And, like, you know, seeing Tyler put out his videos and being like, oh, shit, like, you see what Tyler did? Man, we got to figure out a way to top that. Or, you know, we're kind of stuck in this box that we don't really realize what the rest of the world or how the rest of the world sees us. And it's starting to become a lot more apparent now. And I definitely have to, you know, put myself in that mix of, like, shit, damn near the top directors of that moment of that era. You know what I'm saying? For sure.
Yeah.
When you were doing the video with the internet and Tyler, tell me about that process.
Man, that was a fun video, man. So, you know, I kind of prided my, like, you know, once I kind of established myself as a legit music video director, and I still had these relationships with all these great artists, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, Sid and all the Oz Future, like, I knew them when I was making music, you know what I'm saying? So it was really cool to see them, like, you know, develop Oz Future and then develop the internet and kind of, like, separate themselves and become their own genre damn near.
Yeah.
And so I always told myself, like, look, I'm not really doing music videos with Overdose anymore, but I'm going to make sure that every music video that I do, I want to make sure that I like the song. I want to make sure I like the artist. And so that's why I worked with, like, Anderson .Paak and No Worries and The Internet and Vic Mensa, because these are all artists that I fuck with musically. Like, I don't do music videos for whack artists. Like, I just don't do it because I'm such a fan of music. So, you know, it like, the way that video happened is, like, literally on, like, Christmas Eve at the Fox Hills Mall, I see Sid and I see Matt Martians, and I'm like, yo, what's up, guys? How you guys doing? This new album you guys got is tight. Let's do a video for this song because I fuck with that song. And they're like, okay, cool. And so, you know, we ended up doing those two music videos. And, you know, they had their own particular style at the time, which is like this alternative urban thing. And you know, they were pulling a bunch of references from Jamiroquai, and they wanted to kind of
have that.
That young, grown and sexy feel that we used to see back in the 90s. And so we pretty much just kind of replicated that energy. And then, you know, Tyler, that song that Tyler is on, we actually didn't shoot that video. We didn't intend on shooting the video for the song that he was on, but he just so happened to be there. And so I came up with an idea, like, yo, just like back in the day where they used to, like, always have those little snippets at the end of the video, like, let's just do, like, a 30-second snippet of the song you have with Tyler since he's here. And he did it, man. And it's interesting, man, because, like, I think Tyler is, like, one of those people that, like, he's probably one of my biggest inspirations. And, you know, we grew up in the same neighborhood. And, you know, I used to see him when he was a young kid just, like, skating around the neighborhood. And, you know, we never really had, like, a creative conversation. Like, we never had, like, a conversation where we discussed, like, art or creativity. And so for me to be able to, like, actually work with him and discuss a concept was, like, really, it was like an icebreaker, so to speak, you know, for all the years of, like, you know, under, like secret competition that we've had against each other that he may not even be aware of, but, you know, it was just, like, a cool thing to finally, like, you know, do something with him.
Yeah, and also just to be able to, like, show, you know, everything you're, like, made of and to be on that level, I think that's really meaningful.
Yeah, was there ever a time when you know, aspired to get to a position where it's like, this validates me? Like obviously you went on to win multiple awards, including a Grammy Award. And that's, like, insane. I mean, that's just such an amazing achievement. Did you, like, aspire to win an award like that? Was that like, yo, I'm like on another level? Or did, you know, you get satisfaction in a different way?
I mean, it's a couple of things. I mean, I think the awards are definitely, you know, like, part of it. You know, obviously, I'm not going to deny any kind of awards. Like, that shit is tight. but I think you know, validation from my peers is probably like it's probably ahead of all of that. I think it's funny you mentioned, like, what is one thing I still want to accomplish or one thing that I still want to do, and I may get killed for saying this, but man, I want to do another music video with Kendrick Lamar, man. Like, it's funny because, like, coming up, like, I did, like, maybe two or three videos when he was, like, just now starting off, like, for the Kendrick Lamar EP.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were very collaborative and, you know, we talked frequently. And then, you know, suddenly, like, he just, like, you know, became Kendrick Lamar. And at the same time, you know, I became Calmatic. And I was like, man, I just want to do a video with Kendrick because he's my favorite artist. And, like, fuck, like, please. So every time, like, the album cycle comes around where Kendrick is about to drop, I always try to hit up his managers, Dave and them, and be like, yo, what's up, bro? Like, can we get one in? And it just never really works out, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, it's not really, like, a huge deal for me. Like, it's not the worst thing in the world, but I definitely got to do another Kendrick Lamar video sometime soon, man.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah, I mean, well, what about the time that you held an Oscar?
Oh, with Chris Rock.
Yeah. Oh, you know that story. Yeah.
Man, that was funny because It's funny, me and my dad, we were like, yo, because my dad is my dad used to run track when he was in high school and college. And so the Jesse Owens movie had just came out. And so I was like, you know what? I'm going to take my dad to go see Jesse Owens at the Magic Johnson Theater in the hood. And so we pull up, and he was like, all right, I'm going to drop you off. You go get the tickets, and then I'll park. And so when I hop out the car, I just see a bunch of lights in front of the theater. And I'm like, what the fuck is going on? And I see Chris Rock in front of the theater, like, filming. I'm like, oh, shit. And so, you know, me, like, I've been on sets before, so I know how to, like, navigate a set. I know who to, I know who to talk to, you know, to see what's really going on. So I found a guy, and I'm like, yo, what are they doing? He was like, oh, yeah, they're interviewing people for the Oscars. And I was like, oh, can I please be interviewed? Like, can you please interview me? He's like, oh, yeah, cool, chill, just stick around. And so I was waiting in line, and I was watching him interview everyone else. And then as soon as it was my turn to go, someone can't hop out of a van, and they're like, oh, the trophy is here. We can start shooting with the trophy. And they pulled the trophy out of the case, and I was the first person to go up, and he was like, yo, give me your acceptance speech. And so it was crazy, man. I think that was a fun moment. I think it was kind of weird that on the actual Oscars they said they went to Compton to shoot this, but clearly we were in the middle of South Central, which is like 15 miles away from Compton, but I know Compton sounds better.
Right.
But, you know, it was interesting, man. Like, he was asking, it's funny because he was asking people a bunch of, like, you know, film questions, like, what was your favorite genre of film? Or, like, what did you think about this, like, artsy white film? And the average person was going up there, like, I don't know what that is, or what's that? You
right.
know, trying to show the difference between the cultures. But when he asked me, like, those questions, I had answers for him, and he kind of felt weirded out. And he was like, you know, what's your favorite Meryl Streep movie? And I would be like, Bling Bling Bloom, you know what I mean? And so, you know, I think that's kind of what led to that moment where he gave me the trophy.
Well, okay, so you and Chris Rock have that moment there, and that's obviously, you know, it goes on to be a bit at the Oscars. You know, let's flash forward a little bit later, you do Old Town Road, and Chris Rock has a cameo there. Did you have a discussion and, you know, bring this up and
say,
like,
were you able to, like, connect those two pieces of your puzzle?
Yeah, man. So, I mean, so it's funny. So the day of the shoot, when we knew he was coming, he was in his trailer. And so I had to go in and meet him. And I was like, man, I can't wait to tell him this. So I walk into the trailer. He's there by himself. And I'm like, yo, man, thanks for coming out, blah, blah, blah. Just so you know, like, I'm one of the kids that you gave the Oscar to at the Oscars thing. He was like, oh, okay, that's cool. but I don't think he remembered. And then we went on to shoot the scene, and I'm just like, you know, after every take, I'm walking up to him, and I'm giving him direction and giving him notes on the last scene. And in the middle of me giving him notes, he stops me, and he's like, yo, I remember. Yo, that shit is crazy. Oh, shit, that is you. Oh, this is wild, man. This is wild. This is crazy. And so, yeah, that was a fun moment, man, to, like, know that he remembered. And it's crazy how shit connects like that, man. It's so interesting.
That's incredible, by the way, and very, like, it's just, it's cool to have that full circle moment, and you're, you know, still a young man. It's not like this had to happen, like, 50 years from now.
Yeah, exactly.
when you shot that video, it was an epic undertaking. It ended up being, like, this humongous moment and has done a lot of views, you know, online.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you asked for that video, this gigantic thing, anything that you asked for that you weren't able to, you know, get approval for or pull off?
Damn. Let's see. That's a really good question, man. Okay. This may not be the answer you're looking for, but it's something. So in the video, Billy Ray Cyrus is driving a Maserati, right?
Yes.
And it's like a red Maserati that has like an airbrushed hood on it, the same way that those guys in Texas, like, airbrushed the back of their pickup trucks.
Yeah.
So originally, it was supposed to be a Lamborghini. Because I was like, man, you know, obviously this song is, like, name-calling a bunch of different brands. I don't want to just show the brands and like every time he mentions something, when he says Gucci hat, like I don't want to point to his hat and it's a Gucci hat. When he right. says Maserati, I don't want to see a Maserati pull up. So I was like, let's just do everything the opposite. And so we started off with like an aqua green like Lamborghini that we rented, and it was like amazing. We couldn't airbrush it at all because they wouldn't let us. And I was like, damn, that's fucked up. Like, it would be so cool if you could airbrush a Lamborghini. And they wouldn't let us do it. So we just settled with the Lamborghini. And the first scene that we were shooting, it was Lil Nas's first time ever being on camera. And so he was so nervous. Like, he was like forgetting his words. Like, he just didn't really know how to like turn his swag on. And so we went way over with time. We were like 3 hours behind time wise. And it was going to fuck up everything else financially. We couldn't afford to shoot any other scenes. And so we found a way to get more money by saying, all right, let's do this. Maserati really wants to be in this video so bad. So let's get rid of the Lamborghini. Let's scratch the scenes that he looks awkward. And let's tell Maserati that we want to put their car in the video. And then they gave us the money that helped us make up for the time that we lost with Nas at the beginning. And that's why you see the Maserati in the video. So there's a whole nother video that has a Lamborghini in it, but we just had to scratch those scenes to make sure we can do the whole video.
By the way, so I was listening to you on the Sleeping Giants podcast, and you tell a story about the difference between day one on that shoot and day two. Like, you said that he was like super nervous day one.
Oh yeah.
And then like
So what happened was I think we had 3 days, right? We shot Thursday, Friday, and then we had to do a Monday, you know what I'm saying, for that third day. So the first day we shoot, Lil Nas is a nervous wreck. He like doesn't know who to talk to. He doesn't really have a team. It's literally just him by himself and like one manager, and he's just like, I don't know what's going on. Like the song is getting bigger and bigger as we speak. Like, it's just like all this shit happening. And he was really shy. I mean, you can almost compare it to like how people talk about how Snoop Dogg was in his first music
video.
How he was, you know, wasn't really looking at the camera. Yep. And then that weekend, he performed at Stagecoach, which is like the country western Coachella. And he performed with Diplo and Billy Ray Cyrus. And it was his first time ever performing Old Town Road in front of a crowd.
Yeah.
And it was literally a crowd of like almost a million people. And it was like the moment where it was like, oh shit, this is real. Like, people fuck with this shit. And so then on Monday, when he came back on set, yo, he hopped out the truck. He got two big Samoan bodyguards. He got a blunt. You know what I'm saying? He even though he has a little cowboy outfit, he kind of had his hat cocked to the side, pants were sagging a little bit. And he hopped out the car and was like, "Yo, what's up, cowboy? What are you doing, baby? What's good?" And I was just like, "Oh shit." I was like, at that point, I was like, "All right, it's a wrap. Like, he's out of here. Like, he's officially a star."
Well, I mean, so like, even like. And by the way, that's incredible. Like, but
yeah.
Like, you signed on to the song, and it was sort of like it was getting big, but it wasn't like nearly the huge thing that it became. And so, what was the difference in you when between like your vision of what it was in the beginning, and then also like having to deliver these huge expectations by the end?
I mean, it was interesting, man. Like, I told people, like, so what happened was, you know. I hadn't worked in a while because I had a wedding and I had a honeymoon, so I was out of work for maybe 3 or 4 months. And I told myself, whatever treatment comes in next, I'm just gonna write it just so I can get back in the flow of things. And so my manager sent me this song. They're like, "Yo, there's like this country trap thing. Do you want to try to do this video?" And I was like, "All right." And I literally responded in the email, "Is this a joke?" You know, and they're like, "No, it's not a joke. Like, this is a real deal." And so I was like, "All right." I did some research and I saw that he was like a mean kid, and I was like, "You know what? This feels like Atlanta. Like, this feels like the show Atlanta. It's almost like what would an episode of Atlanta look like if like some random kid from the hood became like a Western singer? You know what I mean? Like, what would the music video look like?" And so that was my biggest inspiration. And so I wrote the treatment with it. Like, all right, look. This is what the video is going to be. Like, if it's like, if they don't fuck with this, then I'm not going to do it, because I'm not going to do like a cliche music video for this kid. And literally, like, the next day after I wrote the treatment, that's when the whole country western chart fiasco happened. And I was like, "Oh shit, this is actually like a big deal." And so, as I was developing the concept, you know, the song got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and more storylines are coming out regarding the song. And I remember the day that I met Nas. So this is like the hip hop gods playing the game. So look, Nas is signed to Columbia Records.
Yes.
Right? Lil Nas X signed to Columbia Records. He goes number one on his birthday, right? Which was the day that I met him. Columbia Records, Nas, and Calmatic. Like, that's just like some weird, wow, like futuristic shit. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, imagine if you told Nas, like, 20 years ago, like, yo, in, like, 20 years, it's going to be, like, a country wrestling thing, Nas. You know what I mean? It just wouldn't make sense. But anyway, so...
Nas, you were the one that gave me an Oscar.
Yeah, exactly. And so anyway, long story longer, like, I sit with Nas, and, like, we're like, yo, man, what do you want to do? And he's like, yo, man, I don't know. I trust you. Like, I think this concept is funny. And then all of a sudden, Will Smith came into play. And he's like, yo, I want to do a remix. And we're like, fuck. And then Billy Ray Cyrus came over and wants to do a remix. And we're like, fuck. And so basically the label was like, yo, can we do four videos? They want to do a regular video. Then they want to do a Will Smith video.
And you were like, it's nothing.
Yeah, no. And I was like, yeah, for sure. Like, more money for me. Like, let's do it. And so I was basically coming up with the concept for each type of video. It was going to be a hood version for the original song, a trap version for the Young Thug remix. I don't know what we're going to do. We were going to do like the Wild Wild West with Will Smith, and then some country thing with Billy Ray Cyrus. And we all had it all planned out. And then at the last minute, they were like, look, we want to do one video and we want to do it for the remix. And we're just going to just combine all the elements. So basically I took elements from all four videos and put them into one video. And so that's the video that you end up seeing. And I think it's funny because along the way, just to answer your question, though, like along the way, I didn't really change anything. Like, even though the song was number one, even though by the time we started filming, there was people driving by playing the song. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't change anything. And I remember there was a moment where, you know, we had that scene with Vince Staples where we had him racing the Impala. And I remember thinking to myself, like, yo, can you believe that I'm about to have fucking Lil Nas X, I'm about to have a dude from the hood race a fucking Impala and a horse down this street in South Central. Like, how the fuck is this even possible? Like, I can't believe they're letting me do this.
So
and
good.
I think, you know, I think the best part about it is that the label didn't really try to butt in and, like, change anything. Like, they trusted me. They trusted my opinions on the culture and on the creativity to make sure that, and to, you know, make sure that I deliver it properly. So aside from all those product placements, like, they pretty much stayed out of the way.
That's dope. Listen, West Coast guy, born and raised, proudly Los Angeles.
Man.
We were out in L.A. a little more than a year ago, and our friend Emery Jones was doing a hat release with Nipsey. So we went down to celebrate that at the store, and the energy there was like it. First of all, the weather was beautiful. The lines were like as far as the eye can see around like every block, and the energy was just like honestly like fantastic. And it felt so good. And we were talking with Nip, and we were talking with, you know, a bunch of our people who showed up. We were talking with strangers. It was just all a beautiful thing. And about a week and a half later, obviously Nipsey was murdered in that same parking lot. And for you, as someone who, you know, again, this is your home, this is your city, this is your guy, what did that unfathomable moment and the moments afterwards mean to you? And if you could talk about, obviously, like one of our mutual friends, Brandon Jinks Jenkins, when he hit LA after the murder, you reached out to him and you guys rode around together.
Yeah, man. I mean, aside from like all my art and all my, you know, music videos and all that kind of shit, I'm just like the biggest fan of LA. You know what I mean? Like, I put in my bio that I'm a filmmaker, artist, and historian. And even though, you know, people might look at that the same way they look at LeBron being a hip hop historian. You know what I mean? I'm an LA historian. I love LA I love LA like no other, and you know, I take pride in its history, and I'm a nerd when it comes to knowing like where people grew up and like what high schools they went to and like where they, you know, sold their first, you know, drugs, whatever. Like, just like, I'm just like obsessed with the stories. And you know, Nipsey was one of those stories. Like, you know, we grew up in this neighborhood, and you know, like the Crenshaw district is like equivalent to like Malcolm X Boulevard in Harlem. You know what I mean? There's all kinds of commerce and just people just walking around. And Nipsey was a pillar even before he was a rapper. You know, him and his brother, like, you know, they used to sell incense and T-shirts and clothes in the center dividers. And like people supported that. Like, you know what I mean? It was nothing to be like, damn, I need some incense. Let me go, you know, to that tall guy with the long hair on Crenshaw and Slauson. He always has incense. You know what I'm saying? And then once he started rapping, it was like, oh shit, like he can rap? Oh yeah, I'm supporting him for sure. And you know, the bigger he got, the more pride we got. And then, you know, it was almost like every time you drive past the store or drive past Crenshaw and Slauson, you would look over to see what progress he had made. You know what I mean? So like one day you're driving and he has socks on the corner. The next thing you know, the cell phone shop is allowing him to sell socks inside. Next thing you know, he has a store. Next thing you know, he has like a little Mercedes Benz. Oh shit, Nipsey got a Benz. Y'all seen Nipsey? He got a Benz, y'all. You know what I mean? That was the vibe. And then you see him on WorldStar, and it's like, oh shit, Nipsey's on WorldStar. And so it was just like this gradual, like, you know, inspiration. Like, we could just, like, it's almost like a you know, you just drive by and get inspired. You know what I'm saying? Like every single time. And so, you know, even down to some of his last, you know, weeks, you know, alive, like I would see him at our local, you know, health food store getting a smoothie, you know, just kind of hanging out, driving around the city. And it was just like a constant reminder that we could actually, you know, do it. We can actually make it. And so, you know, when Nipsey got killed, man, I mean, I can't even explain the feeling that I felt. It was like, it was a stillness. It was like, it's interesting because I live maybe no more than, you know, 2 minutes away from the store. And I remember that Sunday afternoon, it was like the day after my wife told me she was pregnant. And so that Sunday was like a perfect Sunday afternoon. We were just hanging out, watching TV, and then my phone started blowing up, and I went outside and I would just see, and I just saw a shit ton of helicopters, you know what I mean? But it was still extremely silent. And I just felt like that's the way LA has been feeling this whole entire time. There's been like this weird silence, like something is missing. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I think he definitely, you know, inspired, you know, tons of people to like go out and get it. But there's still like, especially in a time like this, you're like, yo, man, what would Nipsey do? Like, fuck. Like, it's kind of hard to explain. Like, I wish I had a more like, you know, heartfelt answer, but it's just like, it's one of those things that it still doesn't make sense. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, I was only, you know, 9 years old when Tupac died, and you know, I felt the sadness, but this is different, man. Like, this is someone we all knew, someone we all touched. You know, when I first got my camera back in the day, I would go around the neighborhoods and like film the different things happening. I would film all the skateboarders, film all the mom and pop businesses. And I remember I went to his shop when he first opened his store, and he let me do an interview with him. And like, he showed me around the store. He encouraged me to keep filming and keep doing my thing. And it meant the world to me, man. So, you know, when he passed, it was just the worst case scenario. And you know, I think after that, I think that the funeral with Jinx, you know, I got lucky, and the day of the funeral, like, you know, a close family friend of mine, you know, was close to Nipsey's family, and they had 3 extra tickets. And so I knew one person that I was going to invite, which was my homie Steve, and I had one more, and I remember that Jinx was in town, and I was like, oh, for sure, I got to bring Jinx to this. You know, I, you know, think Jinx is like, you know, our hip-hop generation's like, voice, you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, he's the guy, you know what I'm saying? So I feel like he had to be there. And so we had that experience going to the funeral together, which is a whole nother thing. And it was just so crazy to turn out the people, you know, the celebrities that were there. You know, me and Jinx were sitting, you know, not even close to the ground, but like in the middle of the Staples Center, and I look 3 seats down, and it's like Chadwick Boseman, you know, crying. And then, you know, we see Vince Staples like leaving the funeral because he couldn't really handle it. And then you look down and you see, you know, TDE dressed in white, you know what I mean? And it's just like this whole surreal moment of like, yo, is this Nipsey's funeral? Like, is that 1500 nothing on stage right now? Is that Battle Cat who just DJed my wedding 2 months ago and now he's DJing Nipsey's funeral? Like, what the fuck is happening right now? Like, this is not real, man. So I think it's just like there has been no closure to that shit, and I don't think we ever will. Like, I think that's going to be like the biggest mystery of all time. It's like, why did Nipsey have to die that way?
Yeah. I remember we were there, and when the first down, like, you know, you sit there and there's such sadness and such this overwhelming, just like,
yeah, right hand to God.
Yeah. And then I mean, like, that dropped, and it was just like, it was such a release for me.
Yeah, man.
To hear that. You know, I in your bio on Instagram, and I think maybe elsewhere, you say that you survived the 92 riots.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, like, how did that time shape you? And what do you think, like, the narrative that people miss from that time? Because there wasn't, you know, white acceptance on the level that there is now of understanding, like, the anger and the pent up, like, rage of being beaten down by a system, honestly, for 400 years. So, like, what do you think, how do you think that shaped you?
Man, I think the reason why, you know, I'm obsessed with the 92 riots is because, you know, it's one of my earliest vivid memories. Like, I was only 5 years old when it happened, but I remember driving around the city, seeing people running, seeing buildings on fire. And it's funny because, like, obviously, you know, especially in LA, like, you know, there's people looting, but, like, to me, this is not a real riot. Like, what was happening in 92 was the real deal. Like, it was real niggas out there fucking shit up, you know what I'm saying? And, like, to me, this riot is, like, just a bunch of weird skaters trying to steal sneakers, you know what I mean? Like, it's not that deep, you know what I mean? And I think one of the things that stood out for me, you know, and my memory of the LA riots in 92 was that there was a certain unity that I had never experienced, or I haven't seen replicated since then. You know what I mean? Like, I've never seen young and older and, you know, strong and smart and intelligent black people from all walks of life come together for one cause. And I think that energy is what stood out to me the most, and I feel like that's the difference. Like, I mean, obviously we're coming together now, but it feels like it's a little bit more digital, and I don't know, maybe that might be a better approach, you know, at this point. But it just felt good to see people, like, have a united cause and actually, you know, do something about it. So I just like to, like, imagine that one day I can see something like that, obviously in different circumstances, but just seeing, you know, black people come together and unite as strongly as we did in 92.
So, you know, we're recording this on Saturday afternoon, East Coast time, Saturday morning, West Coast time. Where is your sense of hope at today, right now, as a black father?
Man, dog, I don't know, man. Like, I've been struggling with that answer. Like, I think, you know, I mean, I can do is compare it to what my dad was going through when he was my age. And, you know, he tells me that, you know, things are better, you know what I mean? And even though it may not feel like it, things are better. And so, you know, hopefully with this revolution, with, you know, who knows, maybe 10 years from now there'll be another one, I just hope that it makes things a little bit better and we do it inch by inch. And, you know, it's not a one size, you know, fits all, you know, like, struggle, you know what I'm saying? But, you know, something is changing right now, and hopefully this benefits my son and his son and his son and his son or daughter, whatever, you know what I'm saying, in the future. I mean, that's all I can hope for. I mean, I just hope that, you know, I don't have to, I think me and my wife were talking yesterday, I think our biggest hope is that when we do have the conversation with our son about race or about racism and inequalities, that it doesn't break his heart. You know what I mean? That it's something that he can, you know, easily understand, and it doesn't change much of how he looks at the world. You know what I mean? And so hopefully it's not, it won't be that big of a jump from what his normal life is. But, you know, if it is, I feel strongly that he'll, you know, he'll adjust just like we adjusted. So, you know, that's all we can hope for is that the reality won't set in too hard.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Cal, it's really been a pleasure to see how your career has moved to this point. I think it's amazing what you have done as a storyteller. I think the future is only bright for you, and I think your voice and Jinx and so many other Black voices are of the most importance these days, and we so look forward to however you create, and whenever you create, and however you create. And listen, thank you so much for this conversation. Be well. We'll be checking in on you, and thanks, man, for everything.
Man, I appreciate y'all, man. And I swear to God, next time, man, when we do it in person, I'm gonna nail my AKA.
Yeah, but that's what you said for this time.
You might have to stop me, man. But I'm a nail it, man. I appreciate y'all, man, for sure, for real, for real.
When you reached out, you were like, yo, like, I really want to make this happen. I got my AKAs on deck. And you were just like, yo, like, Cal's going to come with that fire. Like, I didn't even want to do AKAs.
This point, before the call, I was like, I'm going to write it down. I was like, I ain't going to write it down. I'm ready.
Listen, Cal, we appreciate you. We're sending love to you and yours, and we'll talk to you soon, all right?
All right, man. Peace, man.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this new episode of A Waste of Time with It's The Real. People want to find out more about us. I'm Eric with the curly hair. That is Jeff with the glasses. Together, we are It's The Real. No apostrophe. No spaces. If people want to find out more about this podcast, it's called A Waste of Time with It's The Real. Jeff, people want to find out more about what's going on with us. Where can they go?
You can always go to itsthereal.com, itsthereal.com. You can also go to patreon.com/itsthereal. Twitter, we are at itsthereal over there. If you want to follow us on Instagram, we are at itsthereal over there. You can find our podcast on all streaming platforms, including the one that you're listening to right now, Spotify, talking about Google, Apple, talking about YouTube.
And I think we're finally going to be on Tidal soon. Jeff, is there anyone you want to shout right now?
I want to shout out a few people who have contributed to our Patreon in the past week. I want to shout out CN Rondo, Jimmy Williams, and Patrick Coville.
Jeff, I want to shout out everybody who is out there on the front lines of the protests. I want to shout out everybody who's out there on the front lines protecting us from COVID-19. I want to shout out everybody who is making it through moment by moment, day by day, through the worst economic
Everything
that has been pretty much ever. I want to shout out everybody for making it through. We're doing just the same. As always, guys, not for real, for real.
Sure, sure.
We'll see you guys next week.